It's time for Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 192. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today, Thomas Hunt joins the Gnostic Media podcast to discuss Mad Bitcoins. This episode is being released on Thursday, March 6, 2014, and was recorded on March 5. What's with all the mainstream media hype lately over Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin? What is Mt. Gox? Is Mt. Gox the same as Bitcoin, or is that the equivalent to saying that Enron, or Bernie Madoff, or Al Capone is the dollar? Is Bitcoin really only used by drug smugglers and pornographers? Is it really a government conspiracy for a global digital currency? A Ponzi scheme? Is it really unbacked by anything? Is it something we should all fear because it's not supported by the government, which brought us the dollar that's lost most of its value through usury and inflation? And on a side note, this is the same government that bailed out the banks in 2008, the failed banks. The same government that prints money and then takes one-third of it back every year. You've probably heard most, if not all, of these exaggerations. But what if, instead of believing in spreading propaganda and fear, we got informed on what Bitcoin really is? I've personally done over 6 months research and preparation for doing some shows on this topic. And today, Thomas Hunt joins us from Mad Bitcoins. Mad Bitcoins is a daily YouTube news show covering the exciting world of cryptocurrency. Watch and subscribe at YouTube. Host Thomas Hunt also moderates a more serious weekly Bitcoin panel discussion entitled The Bitcoin Group, available at thebitcoingroup.com, and is hard at work on the new worldcryptonetwork.com. And I also wanted to point out that we have launched a new website to help people keep informed and up to date on all things cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, and that is at coinalive.com. And there is an address for sending Bitcoin donations to Gnostic Media for this episode, and the address is up on the website for this episode or up under donations. And donations, this episode is brought to you by M&A, John, Stephen, Thomas, William, Lewis, Oscar, Joseph, Paul, Barry, Scott, Samuel, Deb, and Stefan. And we do our best to provide just about everything here for free, but your donations and website purchases are what keep us going. And if you like what we're doing, please do donate. And we also ask that you sign up for a membership or a monthly donation because we can't do it without you. We also accept Bitcoin, Litecoin, and Feathercoin donations. Please also check out the store page on the website where you may order Wheat Blows bumper stickers, our books, the DVD, the She Who Remembers archives, the first 5 years of the Gnostic Media podcast, t-shirts, website memberships, and other good stuff. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website is at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can reach me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Thomas Hunt, Mad Bitcoins. Enjoy. Thomas Hunt, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. I've been watching your show, I suppose, for maybe a month, maybe 5 or 6 weeks, right around there. And I get a kick out of it. Your show has been very informative and brought some of the key issues and matters that we're going to be discussing today to my attention. So first off, what I want to ask you is, who is Thomas Hunt? What's your background? What do you do? And then we'll sort of go from there.
Well, I studied history and English in college. And after graduating, I worked for a large law firm for several years doing technical support and databases, basically solving whatever problem they had, sometimes managing hundreds of thousands of PDF pages of evidence or databases. And when I got done with that, I had some free time and I started looking into Bitcoin. And I noticed that Bitcoin had finally jumped from about $20 to $250. And I felt I had missed the boat forever and that Bitcoin was gone. And I had to kind of chase after it. So I started doing daily episodes just to talk about Bitcoin every day because I really thought that what we needed to get Bitcoin from where it was to where we needed it to be or where I wanted it to be was a daily show where we could just get the headlines out there in a simple format for people to understand and to try to mix in some humor. So I started a show at madbitcoins.com, and that's what I've been working on for the last 9 months or so.
Well, and thank you for putting that together. And recently you've done a number of shows with Chris Ellis and Andreas Antonopoulos. And you've gotten some really good information out there, which really brings the center of what Bitcoin and these alt currencies are. And Bitcoin, a lot of people may think that there is just one and it's Bitcoin, but there's actually hundreds of these cryptocurrencies, Litecoin, Doge or Dogecoin, whatever, however people pronounce that, PeepeCoin, and a whole bunch of others out there. Potcoin is a new one that's taking off. There's Mazacoin, there's Auracoin that may just end up helping the Icelandic people kick the system once and for all. So, first off, what is Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is the world's first cryptocurrency. And basically what it is a system that allows you to send money over the internet like you're sending an email. It has a system of addresses and keys, and if you send money to the address, you can unlock it with the key, and then you could spend the money. Bitcoin is fractional, so you don't have to buy an entire Bitcoin. You can send 0.01 or all the way down to 8 digits of a Bitcoin. So you can send around very small parts of this digital currency, making it ideal for tips or micropayments or even nanopayments.
And Bitcoin itself goes down to what, 1 millionth of one Bitcoin that you can send?
It goes down to 8 digits. I think it's 100 millionth is a
100 million.
Satoshi.
Okay, and one unit is called a Satoshi for, which would basically be like a Bitcoin cent, or even a fraction all the way down to
Absolutely.
100
Right now,
million.
it's much less than a cent. It's a
Ooh.
fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a cent.
Right. Now, so Bitcoin is also a protocol. It's a network in and of itself. It's a decentralized network, so it makes it very hard to shut down. What else can you say is Bitcoin? And I know, and a lot of the things that Bitcoin isn't, the altcoins are. And the altcoins, for people who don't know, a lot of them are basically like a laboratory for Bitcoin development. And when they released Bitcoin, it didn't just go out there and they said, that's it. That's Bitcoin version one. We're done. We walk away, and no other development or fixes or anything will ever be done. And so Bitcoin is always in development, et cetera. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And to really understand Bitcoin, you have to understand where digital currencies came from. We had perfectly good digital currencies in the past at eGold and Liberty Reserve, but what these were centralized systems. So when the government took disfavor with them, they just had to roll into this centralized location, seize their servers, shut down their operations, and that was the end of eGold and then later Liberty Reserve. So what Bitcoin was designed to combat this centralization with a decentralized network. When I want to send you a Bitcoin from my wallet to your wallet, or even a dollar's worth of Bitcoin, what happens is that transaction, me sending a dollar to you, needs to be confirmed in the blockchain. The blockchain is like a giant distributed ledger of every Bitcoin transaction since the beginning of Bitcoin time. And they're all up there in the blockchain. Every dollar that you sent to someone, every dollar that you sent to a business, they're all up there. And what happens is a series of computers called miners are constantly looking for the next Bitcoin in the chain. They're performing a great deal of long math to find out, and they're constantly guessing, is this the next number? Is this the next number? While they're trying to find the new Bitcoin, they're also confirming the transactions. If six miners agree that I've sent a dollar to you, that transaction, me, $1 to you, gets added to the great ledger and database of the blockchain. After
And
that,
And let me just ask you, every single computer on the Bitcoin network downloads the entire ledger. So that means every single person who uses Bitcoin from day one to today has the entire ledger. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The computers download the entire blockchain, and it does take several days now to synchronize your local copy of the blockchain wallet. But when you do finish synchronizing, you will have an entire copy of the entire ledger. And this is the only way the system can properly work without a centralized location. There's nothing to seize. There's nothing to shut down. All the Bitcoin miners collectively form the central bank that allows you to exchange Bitcoin.
Now, let me ask you this before we go further, and then we can go into Mt. Gox and all of this nonsense, and I'm sure you're just about sick in the face from talking about that crap. You know, and for those who think Mt. Gox is Bitcoin, that's like thinking Enron is the U.S. dollar. That's about as sensical as propaganda on the mainstream media is. But let me ask you, Tom, what is money?
Well, money, for me at least, going back, is a medium of exchange. It's something that we can use so that we don't have to use the barter system at all times. It's also a convenient store of value so that you don't have to, say, put all your money in milk and then have milk go bad. Money, presumably, is supposed to be steady and a store of value, as well as a transactional medium. So I'd say that Bitcoin definitely is those two things.
And, you know, basically, and who was it recently in the media came out and said that Bitcoin can't be money because money is only something that's backed by a central bank. Oh, boy. You know, and even the U.S. didn't have a central bank in its beginnings.
It was probably someone like Peter Schiff. He's been very anti-Bitcoin lately. And they generally, they say ridiculous things like money should be backed by gold, which hasn't been true in the United States since we went off the gold standard in the 70s. And most people don't even really connect that or aren't aware that the U.S. government system is also a system based on trust and faith. And that's what Bitcoin's value is based on, faith in Bitcoin, faith in the cryptographic code that has been written.
Now, Clint Richardson, who has investigated along with Walter Burian, the CAFR Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, has actually found that some of the U.S. currency is, in fact, by gold, and they still get to buy it at like $41 an ounce. But, you know, this you have to dig way down into their CAF reports. But, you know, what he also exposed was that the Federal Reserve, contrary to what Ron Paul feeds the masses, is actually audited every year, and they have to publish it in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, and it's all in there. And you just have to follow every little line and detail, which he has done extensively. So, you know, a lot of people will say, you know, and I've heard this, you know, Bitcoin, it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a government conspiracy for a global currency, for the new world, you know, a global digital currency for the new world order. What do you have to say about these points?
Well, certainly about the first point, if it is a Ponzi scheme, there's no Ponzi and there's no scheme. A Ponzi scheme is a scheme where a centralized man takes a cut from every transaction. The Madoff scandal was a Ponzi scheme where every investment made with Bernie Madoff resulted in Madoff taking a cut. He takes enough cuts, he makes a bunch of money. It's a Ponzi scheme. So the creator of Bitcoin, who is anonymous and has disappeared, doesn't have any control over your Bitcoins. He may have some very early Bitcoins, and they may also have been destroyed for testing purposes. But as far as the individual Bitcoin transactions, when I send a part of a Bitcoin from me to you, the only people involved in that transaction are me and you. There's no third party except for the miners who confirm the transaction.
And they may get a equivalent of a nickel or a dollar or something out of the transaction for handling the transaction, as opposed to what your bank would get out of, you know, if you go down and you use your ATM, you're ding there, go to the gas station, you're ding there, you know, the only place you can go anymore without getting dinged essentially is the grocery store.
Absolutely. And one of the big advantages of Bitcoin is that current credit cards charge about 3-4% to the small businesses, whereas Bitcoin percentages are usually more like 1%. So it can save a lot of money.
And okay, sorry, go ahead.
As for the New World Order digital cashless society, it seems that there were definitely two tracks to that, and we were already going that direction with the credit cards and with the way that everyone uses their ATM debit card. Bitcoin seems to be counter to that and its own system that they might not have planned for. Things like the internet, things like Bitcoin seem a little bit out of control, and I like to believe that they are out of control.
Well, and they can't control every aspect, but you know, when I do a transaction in Bitcoin, it's pseudo-anonymous. I can track it through the blockchain, et cetera, but it's going to take me a lot more work to get the person's name or what they were buying or anything else, whereas when I swipe my ATM at Office Depot or at Target or at McDonald's, which I would never eat at, you know, they're going to have a detail of everything that I've ever purchased with that credit card, where that is not the case with Bitcoin. And not only that, but correct me if I'm wrong, once I stick Bitcoin up in, you know, a paper wallet somewhere, and, you know, that money is gone until I decide to move it again.
The beauty of the paper wallet system is, while it's a little complicated, it really helps you understand what Bitcoin really is. When you print out a paper wallet, it has the two keys, which are written as QR codes so that you can scan them like a barcode. The one key is your public key. This is where you send the money to. So when you send a dollar in Bitcoin to the public key, you send it there. What the paper wallet is like a padlock that you go up to the blockchain and you lock the padlock on there. Your money stays in the blockchain. It's not on your local computer. It's not on a Bitcoin exchange. It's in the blockchain. And when you come back with the second half of that paper wallet, the private key, you can then unlock that money from the blockchain. So when you store your money in a paper wallet, it's not on your computer. It's not on the exchange's computer. It's actually in the blockchain. So it really can never be taken from you. You don't really possess it. If you cross over a border, they've been trying to search people's Bitcoins, people's money, people's laptops when they go over borders. If you cross over a border with Bitcoin, all you have to memorize is kind of your password. If you can't memorize a password, you could even have a special password made for you from a book, maybe the first character of each sentence from a page that you know. And you memorize the page, and that's it. You get to the other country, you pull a book from a library, you look up your code, suddenly all of your money has moved from one country to another country. I've heard some people compare it to Jesus turning water into wine, the ability to transubstantiate, to create something out of nothing, and that this is truly a superpower, and that it is, that Bitcoin is this superpower that gives people the ability to be your own bank. Each Bitcoin wallet is like a bank.
And, you know, you can, you know, write it on the bottom of your foot or whatever. And, you know, it's funny. And I heard this story the other day. These guys in the airports stopping this guy who had lapels from one of the Bitcoin conferences. And they thought these pens were actual Bitcoins. And they held him in custody for hours while they questioned him about a bunch of lapels that were worth nothing. And they had actually thought that the lapels were real Bitcoins.
It also seems they might have been tipped off to the cassatious coins, which are a small plastic or aluminum coin, which previously were sold with Bitcoins on them. They would have the code for the Bitcoin, and the seller would put a Bitcoin in there and then send you the little plastic coin. And you could give them to your friends and family as stocking stuffers. But the FBI recently cracked down on him, saying that by sending these little plastic trinkets across state lines, he was a money transmitter. So I've heard now he's selling them just blank without the money inside. You can put money inside yourself. But it's unfortunate. It was a pretty great business idea he had. He was selling these little plastic Bitcoins with a real code on the back. You could scan it and bring them into your system. It was like a paper wallet on plastic.
Right. Now, a lot of people have argued that this whole paper wallet idea takes us back to the central banks of ancient Greece or whatever, with the priest standing there in front of the temples exchanging the paper receipts. Is this the same thing at all?
That's a good reference. I mean, I like it. I think it's not entirely unlike that. And Again, the presumably the priests weren't practicing fractional reserve banking.
Well, actually, they were, and that was the whole reason why they got in. You know, because they realized that because the temple is anciently, and you can read like David Astle's book, The Babylonian Woe, and there's a number of other books that go into the history of this. But the ancient the ancient temples in general, we have the story of Jesus going into the temple to kick over the money changers' tables, right? The temple was the bank. That's why the temple in Jerusalem held so much gold, etc. But, so they realized that they could, in fact, do fractional reserve and, make money off of these receipts. Now, to me, how I see the receipts is, one, it's basically... the more I've studied Bitcoin, I kind of see like the address system that it uses is like, the computations for the number of addresses is about equivalent to, like, I've heard it said, like the number of grains of sand and stars or all the atoms in the universe or something like that. So basically your Bitcoin address number is like, to me, it would be like an address to the atom. And then you would have another number that's twice as long as that to try and get inside the atom once you got to the atom. And so, they can't fractional reserve it. You could give it to somebody and say, hey, there's this much on this receipt or whatever, and I'm giving it to you to go cash out, as a payment for something. But each one has a different value. It is not, it cannot be used fractionally and does not have interest or these other things attached to it.
What's nice about Bitcoin that I think makes it different from the temple receipt system is that Bitcoin is not a black box. I don't know how many receipts they have in that box. I don't know how many times they've sold the goat or whatever they're reselling fractions of. With Bitcoin, you can actually cryptographically confirm without knowing where the money is, without knowing how to get the money, you can confirm that the money's there. Part of the Mt. Gox problem recently is that it was run by one person. One computer programmer seems to have held the keys to their entire system, controlling the programming, controlling the location of their cold storage, controlling their hot storage. He controlled all aspects of the security. So we really don't know what happened there. I think that exchanges in the future are going to be cryptographically proven, that they're going to have a tree of links to their accounts. And this program's going to go through and confirm that all the money's in their account. And when I log in, up at the top, it's going to say, this is a 97% confirmed reserve. And it's going to say that they have the money that I'm trading with. Because when you go to an exchange like Mt. Gox, one of these Bitcoin exchanges, or even a stock market exchange, if you want to talk about that, you're not really trading stocks. You're not really trading Bitcoins. You're trading temporary chips that when you cash out will be exchanged for Bitcoins or exchanged for stocks. They keep all the trading in-house. It's a lot faster and a lot simpler.
From what I understand, Blockchain Info is trying to change the way that this works.
Blockchain.info has a very unique and different wallet storage system. As we talked about earlier, the paper wallets is what Bitcoin is. It's a public key and a private key. There are two halves to it. And what your exchange like Mt. Gox would do is they actually hold the private keys. So when you had Bitcoins in Mt. Gox, you never owned them because you never owned the private key. What blockchain will do, and it's a bit complicated with computers and math and stuff, but basically they compile the wallet on your computer. So when you put your code in, blockchain doesn't know what's in your wallet. Blockchain can't edit your wallet if there's a mistake. It's all on your computer. Whereas Mt. Gox was the exact opposite kind of system. Mt. Gox knew what was in your account. They could change it if there was a problem. And as we saw, unfortunately for a lot of people, they restricted the ability of these people to withdraw from their accounts.
The situation with Mt. Gox, and a lot of people think that it happened suddenly and overnight and all of this stuff, which is a bunch of nonsense. Actually, within the community, for those who were deep enough in, Mt. Gox had been warned about for about 2 years. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I got rather heavily into Bitcoin last April. And even at the time, learning small things about Mt. Gox, like the fact that the initials stood for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange, were big red flags to me, even as an amateur investor, that maybe this was the first company, but maybe it's not the best company. When I got into Bitcoin in April, I was really excited to see the corporate support. When I looked into Bitcoin a few years ago when it first came out, I thought it was a great idea, but without any programmers or corporations around to write the software that we needed, I wasn't sure that we'd get technically to the point we needed to get. I'd seen similar failures with the Linux system, where Linux was superior to Windows and Mac, but it never received the money to build the kind of software to make it user-friendly to really compete with those people on the desktop level. But when I checked in a few years later, perhaps because Bitcoin is money and it now seems to fund the kind of solutions that we need because it's money, it really seemed like the support was there. Companies like Coinbase really provide an easy way for people to get Bitcoins even without understanding math or public-private key encryption, like I've been talking about.
All right. So, and as far as we know, Mt. Gox had never done an audit, and this guy, Mark, had basically either committed a massive fraud or was, major scheme fraud, or was just so massively incompetent, but it's looking more and more like a scheme, because obviously, you know, the rest of the Bitcoin community had worked together, BTCe, some of these other exchange websites, and hammering out as quickly as possible, making sure all the software updates and everything were handled, whereas Mt. Gox appears to have intentionally avoided things and claimed to have been too busy to fix a problem that cost $400 million. Now, you couldn't, hire somebody to, or many somebodies for that much money to handle the situation.
It seems very much to be an echo of the dot-com situation, where you had a bunch of non-business people with a lot of venture capital cash. Mt. Gox had an incredible influx of money. They were one of the most popular Bitcoin exchanges, even at one point handling 70% of the Bitcoin traffic. I believe they had a small team of programmers. I'm not sure if they expanded beyond that team. I'm not sure they reinvested in their product. And I'm pretty sure it led to this situation today. They blamed an old bug called transaction malleability, which is very complicated, but to put it kind of basically, if you manage the transaction, if I'm sending a Bitcoin out of Mt. Gox to you or to someone else, they can render the transaction with or without spaces. It turns out if you do the transaction with spaces, the number that you get as a confirmation could be a different number. If the confirmation number is different, then your system could say, well, I guess the Bitcoin wasn't sent, and then allow the user to send the Bitcoin a second time. If you can send a Bitcoin twice, you can get two instead of your one. If someone does this enough times to you, suddenly you don't have a massive reserve of Bitcoin. They're gone. We don't know for sure that this is what happened to Mt. Gox. Part of the problem is that they're completely a black box. We have no idea what goes on inside there. And this is pretty much true for the other exchanges, but they are better with communications. Mt. Gox has been especially bad with communications. And they blame this transaction malleability, perhaps hackers or perhaps incompetence, for the complete loss of 850,000 Bitcoins at this point.
I've also noticed, and on Bitcoin forums, Bitcoin Talk, whatever it's called, a number of upset people beginning to build around Cripsy for similar issues and not being able to get money out and things like that. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, there is a geographic distance. Mt. Gox was based in Tokyo, Japan. Cripsy, I'm told, is based in Florida. Cripsy is attempting to get USD withdrawals, which is the major feat for all of these exchanges, the ability to transfer your money instantly to USD and then back into Bitcoins, really opens up your trading possibilities and allows people to hide their money if they think that the Bitcoin price is going down. Cripsy has been adding a lot of new servers lately. They have had many issues like this where the queue gets behind and they won't cancel your transactions fast enough. They've had withdrawal issues. I believe that Cripsy is a good company in working to fix these problems. I don't know the specific issues that people are having, but I hope they'll continue to work with Cripsy, and I hope Cripsy continues to work. Cripsy is a major exchange for our community. They have over 150 altcoins. Cripsy is kind of the random altcoin place, if you will. And it's even become lately So that Cripsy is a final destination for a lot of altcoins. A lot of altcoins are on even smaller exchanges than Cripsy, and they're attempting to fight their way up to get onto Cripsy, presumably so that the price will go way up and a lot of people will sell them.
Now, is there the potential sense, obviously, Cripsy, like Mt. Gox, holds the coins. Is there a potential for a repeat here?
Absolutely. There's a lot of uncertainty around the Bitcoin exchanges. Cripsy does hold all the keys. BTC-E is a Bulgarian exchange and is founded by anonymous members who apparently have some kind of banking system that allows them to take profits and still remain anonymous. I'm told that it slowed down withdrawals from BTC-E in the past. There are only a couple of other exchanges, major exchanges. Bitstamp, which accepts a EUK and US dollars, so it's an international exchange. Coinbase, which is really just a Bitcoin to USD type company, or USD to Bitcoin, either way. And then Kraken. There's only a few other exchanges. Kraken is also based in the United States, but they are not doing USD withdrawals right now. They prefer if people do euro or pound withdrawals.
So, you know, what is the solution? I mean, obviously, with Bitcoin in general, the idea is that you take responsibility for your own finances and stop relying on mommy and daddy government or mommy and daddy bank to handle everything for you. And so, you know, to me, it seems that the most likely or the most obvious way to protect yourself is to put maybe 90-95% of your funds into paper wallets or into cold storage and only keep, you know, 5 or 10% up on these websites so that you don't hear these horror stories of people losing 650 bitcoins or about, you know, $650,000+.
Absolutely. Paper wallets are the most secure, although they can be a little difficult to get together. And to really make a paper wallet the way it's supposed to be made, you need to have an offline computer that you can still print with. That's a little, and you need to boot off a Linux CD so that it has a hard written set of drivers and you can make sure that no one's key logging you. This is a bit tough for a lot of people. I'm working on ways to explain it in how-to videos, but I would definitely say storing your Bitcoins in offline storage on paper wallets, in encrypted and backed up local wallets on your local computer, but then backed up to Dropbox, something like this, or just storing them in multiple exchanges. Mt. Gox was the only exchange that went out of business in the last 3 or 4 months. If you had had your money split up into Coinbase and BTCE and Bitstamp, you would have only lost the money in Mt. Gox. It seems it's very unfortunate. I don't know what it's like for the people that had hundreds of thousands of dollars and then lost them in Mt. Gox. It must be incredibly heartbreaking. We kind of call them Bitcoin rich, but a lot of the Bitcoin rich seem to have been keeping, you know, for a normal person, a large amount of Bitcoins, 550 Bitcoins on Mt. Gox, just because it was convenient and because it didn't really matter to them. Perhaps they have 5,000 Bitcoins and to them 500 is a small amount or even more. But yeah, it seems there's a lot of laziness, a lot of not looking into your investment. If your investment was a couple $1,000s and it turned into $100,000, you need to treat it differently than you would if it was a couple $1,000 investment. No one keeps $100,000 in their normal checking account. If you're doing that, certainly our banks have insurance, they're more secure, but especially in the Wild West of Bitcoin, if you're keeping $100,000 in your checking account, there's a chance it might not be there.
And all of the people really who lost their money were people who ignored the last 2 years of warnings or weren't up on the community with Bitcoin, et cetera. And, you know, while they had an interest in Bitcoin, they kind of probably just bought them or were day trading on Mt. Gox. And then those were the people who lost everything. Those who, you know, and I'll admit I myself had money in Mt. Gox last year that was stuck there for over a month, and they managed to get quite a large sum out of me. I mean, it was, last year, but I still managed to get 5 or 6 Bitcoin stuck in there. And then I finally had to threaten them to do a radio show on negative press about them. And then finally, the next day, my Bitcoins were released.
Absolutely. Mt. Gox has had perhaps, you know, 6 to 10 of these events where U.S. withdrawals were frozen or Bitcoin withdrawals were frozen. A lot of people were, I don't know why, but a lot of people were stuck and they didn't realize that they should have just sold all their fiat into Bitcoin, transferred the Bitcoin out, and then converted it back into fiat somewhere. They could have certainly taken some losses. The Bitcoin is a volatile currency at this point. But, and that certainly in the last, you know, 6 months, that might not have worked because Mt. Gox did eventually freeze even Bitcoin withdrawals. But there was a period last year where U.S. withdrawals were frozen, but not Bitcoin withdrawals. And if you convert your currency and transfer it out, you don't have to take the ultimate hit of losing all your money. So.
Yeah, it was just, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous. So now that Mt. Gox is dead, obviously Bitcoin died with it. Is that correct?
That's definitely what the papers said. The papers were all very clear that when the U.S. stock market went down in 1929, the dollar ceased to exist as a currency. When you know, Black Tuesday, Black Thursday in the 80s, when they had that big sell-off, that it stopped to exist as a currency. Yet still people are trading for barrels of oil in U.S. dollars. Still, they're printing them out every day. No, Bitcoin is still here. Mt. Gox didn't kill Bitcoin. There's been a lot of great hyperbolic articles written, a lot of really great headlines that the media has had a chance to trot out. But they're going to have to bring them back in a few weeks. The media, they don't understand how to explain the entire world converting to a digital currency. So whenever they try to explain this, they fall back on things that they've already seen. They see that Bitcoin must be a bubble. It must be a Ponzi scheme. It must be like the tulips, and it must be like the dot-com boom or the Beanie Babies. You can get the bingo card at home and you can drink along. It's not any of these things. It's an amazing new digital currency. What's so interesting about Bitcoin is that it's not just a digital currency. What Bitcoin really is a computer science solution for the Byzantium generals' problem.
Are you sure that you're just, you know, not a Bitcoin believer and you just can't face the facts? You're just, you know, clouded in Bitcoin religion, you know, which is actually the opposite. I've actually seen all of these ad hominem attacks, and these people really don't grasp what Bitcoin is. And I mean, it's really hard to get your head around it. And for the audience, I should mention that we have put together a new website with the core information to really help people get the grammar on Bitcoin as fast as possible, and that's at coinalive.com. And so everyone can hit that up, and a lot of Tom's videos and Andreas Antonopoulos and Chris Ellis and a lot of people that you work with are up there, and many other people, this kid working on Ethereum, etc. So we're trying to get the ideas in a digestible form out to the people so that they can really get what it is. But, you know, that is the issue, is that people just, it's beyond most people's comprehension. And people that don't have a technical background, you know, I was a network administrator and network engineer, so you doing databases. So, you know, to me, it was natural to kind of look into this, and I put it off for a couple of years, and people kept approaching me, and it was like, you know, when looking back, I should have done it years earlier. And, you know, so there is a lot of this confusion that surrounds Bitcoin. And then you have, I think, governments with their suppressive taxed fiat currencies that are, and the bankers that are extremely afraid of this and pumping out as much propaganda about it as they can.
Absolutely. And it's easy to see that I could be labeled as someone that's just overtly pro-Bitcoin. But what makes Bitcoin so different from the dot-coms or the tulips is that you didn't need to be a technical specialist to understand a tulip. A tulip was beautiful. It had bright colors. It must be worth more. Bitcoin is actually a network. It's actually a series of code, and the software itself has value. The problem that it solves has value, and it has so much more value than just currency. Currency is only the first application, and if it's Bitcoin, if it's Litecoin, if it's another one of the altcoins, Bitcoin as currency is here to stay. And what's going to happen next is that other applications are going to be built on top of this Bitcoin network, because what Bitcoin really provides us is a consensus engine. And what a consensus engine allows us to do, and going back to the Byzantium generals problem, is that if you had a city and you've just conquered it and you have 20 different generals spread across the city, how can you get these generals to agree on what your next plan is? How can you get them to agree on anything with timing or anything else in a system? What you need is a trusted ledger like the blockchain, where your generals can all collaborate so that you can get agreement on things, agreement on troop movements, agreements on what the plan should be. And that's what Bitcoin is.
Well, that might scare plenty of people because, you know, ironically, and I'll, let me just throw this in, with as Bitcoin and these alt currencies defund government currencies, the governments are going to be having more and more trouble funding military to go around stomping on people and stripping their rights away. But go ahead.
Absolutely. And what it's going to allow is this power isn't being given to the military or the generals, who essentially already have this power through their telecommunications network, through their satellites. They have incredible command and control. They can already solve this problem with the technology that they have. But what this gives is this gives the ability to solve this problem to the people. And that in the future, what's going to be happening with Bitcoin is not just going to be money, it's going to be voting. The main service that the government allows us, you know, on the face, is the ability for people to agree in mass on decisions, a decision-making engine. It's, you know, through proxies,
yeah.
Perhaps.
I mean, you know, with the left-right paradigm and, you know, all sure, the Hegelian sure, dialectic and all of that.
But going back to its basic goals of what a government should be is serving the people's interests. And if we had a system like a voting system where we could vote on almost everything, as well as something that I'm interested in, which I call fractional voting, where if I wanted to give my vote to a representative, they could then vote with my vote. But if I wanted to change my mind and take my vote back, I could the next day, but I couldn't change any of their past votes. This would allow representatives to become more powerful than other representatives if people agree with their decisions.
Well, see, you know, I think, and I mentioned to you earlier Larkin Rose, and I refer the audience to my, I think, 5 shows with him. He's done a tremendous job in exposing the fallacy that is government, and it's basically a religion where people put on costumes and then go commit crimes against other people that they normally wouldn't commit. And any functionality in government of getting things done already comes from the people. And so, you know, what we need is to get back to sort of a sovereign idea of society where people do have, you know, like eBay, you know, if a seller is bad, they get lots of bad stars and you don't buy from them anymore. But eBay or a local stop sign or your local grocer is a perfect example of how a true anarchy system should work.
And I believe that Bitcoin can provide that kind of a system with software. Software is the new stop sign. It's the new rules of the road. And if you want to get involved in Bitcoin, you can get involved directly in the software. You can get involved spreading the word about Bitcoin, even just owning a few, giving out a few dollars to friends. Anyone can get involved, and Bitcoin is entirely grassroots. There's no Bitcoin company. No one works directly for Bitcoin, the company.
What do you say to people who claim that the government has been accepting Bitcoin payments?
Well, I mean, there might be some confusion. There are some companies where you could send Bitcoin to them and they would convert it to dollars and they would pay your taxes for you. So in that way, the government is accepting Bitcoin.
Well, not directly. I mean, they're still accepting dollars from the company who exchanges it. So still there's nobody, you know, no government agency that I'm aware of in any country that accepts Bitcoin as payment. Are you aware of any?
Not any that takes it as payment. I do know that the FBI is one of the largest single holders of Bitcoin after the Silk Road raid.
Right. And of course, and those have been black marked as well, correct?
It's interesting. We do know where they are. They're in a wallet and we can tell if they are moved. So if the government was to sell them or to get rid of them in some way, we would find out about it. But it's difficult to find out where they were moved after that. It's pretty much a one-hop system.
Right. So at least the wallet has been marked, but people know if anything moves from there. And of course, I think you and I both agree that the war on drugs is a big scam in the first place. So let's see here. Let me ask you this. Do you feel that the mainstream media has been pumping out bad information about Bitcoin to create their own or like the intelligence agencies' own buy options? It seems to me that about every 3 weeks, some major bad story about Bitcoin comes out, and then there's, you know, a big buying frenzy.
Well, we have had a rough couple of months with the China story. Before that, the Silk Road story, and of course, more recently, the Mt. Gox story. These have been all legitimately bad news for Bitcoin, although the China story was a bit overstated. When it first came out, it was said to be a ban on Chinese banks getting involved in Bitcoin. Everyone freaked out, believed it to be a ban on Chinese individuals. About 3 weeks later, after a massive sell-off, the exchanges came back and said, "We think these rules are just about banks." And they turned everything back on, and it was as if the sell-off never should have happened. The Silk Road sell-off lasted about 4 hours before it instantly came right back up. The Mt. Gox sell-off has lasted maybe 2 or 3 days, the real hardcore portion of it, but it seems over now. Bitcoin keeps bouncing back from these events. So what's so interesting about the media using this hyperbolic language that Bitcoin is dead, which is their core thing. Whenever anything goes bad, Silk Road goes down, Bitcoin's dead. Mt. Gox, China cancels Bitcoin, Bitcoin's dead. The more they use this crazy language, the more people are going to say, Bitcoin's not dead. If they keep saying it's dead, it's not dead. What is this thing that keeps not dying? And that's what Bitcoin is.
Now, Bitcoin, they claim, is only used by drug dealers and money launderers and child pornographers. Is that true?
It's not true, but Andreas has a great saying about this. He says, if your currency can't buy drugs, it can't buy prostitutes, it can't buy gambling, it can't buy illegal weapons, what good is your currency?
Now, you know, and these examples are always hilarious to me. You know, they'll drag all this stuff all over the media. Oh, look, they're laundering Bitcoins. Oh, look, Bitcoin is unstable. Oh, look, this company, you know, collapsed. You know, but it's like, okay, well, let me remind you of Enron. Let me remind you of inflation and usury and how, you know, 100 years ago, a dollar was worth like, you know, equivalent of $50 or $100 today. I think $5 was $100 back then, or equivalent, excuse me. And so, you know, we have all of these same things. You know, I've always bought my weed with dollars. So I don't get, you know, why Bitcoin would be any different. I mean, exactly. I hope I can go trade a bag of weed for my Bitcoins. And in fact, thank goodness, there is Potcoin to help the medical marijuana community for exactly this purpose, because, you know, they've been trying to be able to get their money from the dispensaries into banks for years, but the banks are locked up. So now there's Potcoin so that they can move the money into Potcoin and then exchange it out. And then, you know, people in the medical marijuana community can then use the Potcoins to buy cannabis, and you know, the dispensaries can use it as a system of store and a system of cash to buy and trade around. So I mean, you know, all they do at this point, when they create more problems for these, you know, activists and communities, is the activists and communities are going to be taking these measures now, and they're never going to be able to trace it again.
Well, and remember that cash is still the most laundered currency. Cash still buys most of the weapons in the
sure.
world.
It doesn't,
cash
doesn't
still buys all, most of the drugs.
Doesn't all every $20 bill, like 90% of them, have traces of cocaine on it?
Absolutely. And now, even now, more so, in the Washington, D.C. area.
So what you're saying then is like, what's going to happen is instead of cocaine on $20 bills, it's going to be on paper wallets?
There is a belief already that a lot of the Bitcoins have already been tainted by the Silk Road. So if you were to taint all the coins, which is like a marking or labeling system, you would find that, sure, a lot of these coins have already been used by the Silk Road. But if you look at a human, every single atom that's in our body was forged in the sun.
Right. So what you're saying, it's like the dollar, like all the dollars have been associated with drugs and all the Bitcoins too.
Well, and remember when the
internet there's no difference in that regard.
Well, and when the internet first came out, that this was where pirates and pornographers and child molesters hung out, and it was all this scum, and it was the cantina at Star Wars, and all those things. What is the internet now? The internet is where everyone hangs out. Everyone is on the internet. Everyone uses it all the time. You're all a bunch of nerds. Sorry to let you into that, but you're all nerds now. And Bitcoin is going to be the same way. Right now, we're saying that it's where all the drug dealers and the gangsters hang out. Well, in 5 years, in 10 years, maybe less than that, Bitcoin's going to be where everybody hangs out. Bitcoin is an easier way to spend money on the internet, and it's because it reverses the credit card paradigm. Credit cards are a system designed in the 1950s, before the internet, before computers. When you give someone your credit card secret number, you're essentially giving them your private key in the Bitcoin world. They can then charge as much as they want if they have your private key. Bitcoin is the opposite. If I'm going to send you $10 for a service, I go to my account, I go to my bank, I initiate the transfer sending you $10. I don't give you control of my account and say, just take $10 out. Trust me, just take $10. I send it. I initiate the transfer. Bitcoin is more secure. It doesn't send out your personal information like your address, making identity theft possible. Bitcoin ends identity theft. It's superior money for the internet.
Now, don't we need government regulation on Bitcoin?
I don't think so. I think that...
Of course, that was a loaded question.
Of course, but... I mean, generally, some people want it. They think it'll make their businesses more safe and more secure if they have rules to work by, if they have a basic framework. The government has said so far that the existing money laundering rules are enough to keep Bitcoin in check. And that, as you've seen with the Silk Road shutdown, the FBI can clearly keep doing their job with Bitcoin. The fact that the Silk Road was accepting Bitcoin did not stop the FBI in shutting them down.
Even though technically it should have, because it's the legal tender stamp on the dollar that gives them actually any authority to interact in a transaction between two people.
It depends. It might have been the Secret Service's jurisdiction because they have control over currency. But either ways, the FBI has been able to break down these people. They are able to do their jobs. And Bitcoin is going to be the currency of the future.
All right. So what about other propaganda going on out of the mainstream media? What are the other big major lies that have been fed to the population that you hear on a regular basis that we should probably get out of the way?
Just about Bitcoin. I mean, mainly they really do repeat the same ones over again. It is always Ponzi scheme, bubble, Beanie Babies, and dot-com boom, and tulips. They love to, and I love that we're talking about tulips and that we get to bring Dutch history into this, and that there's this time where instead of currency, they use tulips, and the tulip bulbs were sold as futures, and the brighter and the more pretty and more aesthetic the tulip, the more it was valued. And, you know, that was not a good system of money. Tulips ran out of value very quickly. Bitcoin, they say it's the same system, but they ignore all of the software. And with Bitcoin, we have this incredible open source software that's being built that manages the network, which provides value. And that's where the value is. It's in the software. If you look at the internet and you said the internet's only for email and it's an email system, well, the internet would still have value as an internet system, as an email system, something that gives you the ability to email. And the internet, as we've seen, did so much more than that with streaming video, streaming audio, everything else that we do take for granted. Bitcoin is in the same thing. It's right now, it's very early internet. We can only do email type transactions, sending this currency around. But in the next few years, we're going to be able to do contracts. We're going to be able to do wills and trusts. If you think about a contract, if you think about computer science language and being able to program money. If the person is over 50 years of age, pay them $100 every month from this account. That's a will expressed in computer language. And once it's locked into computer language and encrypted and encoded into the blockchain, that will is no longer subject to government or any kind of lawyer or accountant. It'll be executed every month until there's no more money in that account.
And so the bankers and the lawyers and all of these middlemen are completely extracted out of the equation. And of course, these are the very people who have been causing all of this trouble.
Absolutely. And this is the same system that was overturned in 1997 with the MP3. You had a system where music was being delivered through an inefficient system of trucks, little plastic discs, and guys at Tower Records. And it was also being delivered by middlemen who would assign the artists to contracts and take cuts from them. None of those people were needed. The only people we needed were the artists at one end and the people listening to music at the other end. And the internet filled in the middle. And what we thought would happen is that artists would go back on tour, they would sell t-shirts and posters at their shows, and that is what happened. The artists had to go back on tour, Tower Records went out of business, the little plastic discs are hardly made anymore, and the middlemen are all in desperation for their jobs, and the same thing's happening to the movie industry, and the same thing is going to happen to the financial industries because of Bitcoin. New technologies are disruptive. The future is exciting. It's not like the past. It's brand new. And that's what people need to realize.
It really, you know, the Wild West, isn't it? I mean, it's like brand new frontier here. And to me, it's really exciting. And, you know, getting into it at first, you know, it is frightening. There is so much propaganda out there. And if you don't have, you know, critical thinking to spot all the BS, and wade through all of the logical fallacies that they use, it can be far more intimidating. But, you know, there does seem to be much more to this. And, you know, all of these people claim, well, you know, what if Bitcoin itself fails? Well, again, there's 300 altcoins that offer different software capabilities and things, and all of their extra capabilities can eventually be added in on top of Bitcoin, et cetera, whatever it becomes. And this kid, you know, with Ethereum, et cetera, who is doing all of this work. I mean, these are some pretty fantastic things. And you know, the thing that I find the most interesting, Tom, is that nearly all of the information seems to be coming from guys younger than you and I.
Absolutely. The younger generation is very much involved in Bitcoin. If you look at the Sacramento Kings' decision to accept Bitcoin as a team for both tickets and for merchandise in their team store, it's not because of the credit card deals. It's not because of the superior technology or any of the things I've been describing. It's because the billionaire who owns the Kings, his kids came to him and said, "Hey, Dad, your team's not cool. You should accept Bitcoin." And that kind of attitude that Bitcoin is the cool money and that dollar bills and credit cards are the old system.
That inflationary, suppressive tax money that, you know, has military guys bombing other countries and kicking in your door? That money?
They don't even need to know that. It doesn't even matter to them. They don't even care that they're replacing that. They're such a Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook generation. They just want it to be on their phone. They just want to pay with their phone. They don't care that it's encrypted, that it has no centralized server, that it's technologically superior. They just want to pay with their phone. They want to send money to their friends with their phone. They want to email money. And unless cash comes out with a competing product, which is certainly possible, but I don't think it's going to happen, they're not going to be able to compete. This is the MP3 versus the CD. One of them's a big piece of plastic. You want to send it somewhere, you got to pay money. Other one is digital. You want to send it somewhere, it's free. You want to make a backup copy, it's free. You want to break it into parts, put a little bit in an investment account, a little bit in a savings, whatever, it's free. It's your money to deal with now, and it's superior to that old cash money where to even move around, you have to follow all kinds of rules and wait all kinds of waiting periods.
Now, what do you have to say to the people who are frightened by the idea that you know, that this is a global currency, although to me, clearly not any government behind it, totally by the people, for the people. What do you have to say to all of the people that say, you know, hey, this, you know, this is, you know, the governments, they're going to take over the world. This is what they've been waiting for. And, you know, you're just being a sucker for you're playing right into their hands here.
I certainly think those people should do their own research and make their own decisions. And if that's what they believe after they've done the research, that's fine. That's their decision. I do think that there was a government push towards a cashless society. And I believe they were focused on credit cards. And I believe you see that if you look at the payment options of the store. And they keep trying to make it just a little bit faster and just a little bit easier. And I'm not talking about with cash, like
and
with
they
a credit
and they
card.
But they track everything that you buy. And if you have one of those cards that you shop with, you know, where you get the extra sale discount for using it, then they know literally everything that you have purchased, and they can keep track of that. And, you know, is not Bitcoin and all these alt currencies, aren't they the antithesis of that?
Well, it's not just Bitcoin. It's the whole idea that we've been having recently since the Snowden revelations and since all the Facebook, Apple, Google, everyone's spying on us now. People are seeming to come back to the value of privacy and of security, and they don't want to be tracked in every way as it was before. They want new systems from Apple and Facebook where they won't be tracked. They want Google to encrypt their traffic on their data servers so that it won't be sniffed on by the FBI. And these new people are coming to Bitcoin, and they want the same security and privacy from their social media that they want from Bitcoin, from their money. And with Bitcoin, they're actually going to get it. You can actually buy things, and just the only thing that Bitcoin proves is that you paid.
All right. And there was something else I was just going to ask you. You reminded me of something, and then it just slipped my mind. But all right. So why don't we get into mining for a little bit here? What is mining? What is this concept of mining? You know, when people think of mining, they think of somebody going outside and digging in the ground and digging up silver or gold or coal or platinum or something. But what is it when somebody mines in the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency world? What are they doing, and what is the service being performed there? And let me just add here before you answer that, you know, originally I thought the value of Bitcoin came from magic fairy pixie dust, you know, and so it was a you know, long and slow awakening to realize that, you know, one, all of these different services, you know, cryptography, running the network, all of these things are being performed. Primecoin, for instance, you know, looking for the last 23 prime numbers or whatever they're doing, and this new Rycoin on the similar fashion, et cetera. So, what do you have to say about all this sort of stuff?
Well, I do think that prime numbers are a good point to start. And what I would say about Bitcoin mining is that Bitcoin mining actually adds value to the process. It's a similar system to the one that The Economist described so many years ago, where you take jars of money and you bury the jars of money in the ground, and then you pay someone to come along and dig the jar of money back up. That adds value to the money. It increases the value in the system. What Bitcoin mining is let's go back to prime numbers. A prime number 3, 5, 7, 9. Well, what you'd be looking for then is the next prime number in the system, in the sequence. You've been looking for 11. Right? So what your computer's doing is it's running a complicated math problem where it multiplies two numbers together and it tries to see if the answer is 11. So it's constantly checking and it's doing hundreds of these problems per minute, maybe hundreds per
And
second.
we're talking mega numbers here, right?
Big numbers, much bigger than 11 or 9 or any of these things, but it's a simple way of understanding. When the computer discovers the new number, the miner that discovers 11, a block is declared. And what a block is it means that all the transactions in that block, me sending $1 to you, someone else sending 10 cents to someone else, they're all confirmed now. That means that me sending $1 to you is now confirmed in the ledger. It's been added to the blockchain. And additionally, the miner gets the new Bitcoin, which is a reward.
Or
They
in this
get
case, the prime coin, right?
or Primecoin, whatever it is, they would get right now it's about 25 Bitcoins. So the miner obviously wants to do it to get the reward. They also want to do it to get the very small amounts that are paid as transaction fees. When I send $1 to you, I maybe send a penny to the miner. And if everyone sends them a bunch of pennies, they'd have a lot of pennies. And but these problems are so large that the miners are actually working in a pool to solve this problem with everyone putting in their work product of, oh, I checked this number, I checked this number, it's not that. And they're all working together, and there's different pools competing to guess these different prime numbers or large numbers, whatever they actually are. And that this is what Bitcoin mining is. This is the network that provides that keeps the blockchain up to date. Because basically, we don't have a central bank with a central ledger and a bunch of bureaucrats that we pay to update the ledger. We have a decentralized ledger and a bunch of decentralized bureaucrats that we pay to update the ledger. And that's what mining is.
So you mean basically people like you and I can go out and mine and be a part of the ledger and keep track of the whole thing, and then it's open source, so you can actually go in and look at it, right?
Absolutely. And there's new ways of mining. It started out, mining was supposed to be a CPU process. So you'd have one miner, one vote, one computer, one vote. What happened then is that people figured out that you could use your graphics card to to mine Bitcoins. And the graphics cards were hundreds of times faster than the CPUs. Then people developed specific chips called ASICs. I believe it's application-specific independent chip, something like that.
Right.
What an ASIC is it's like a Pentium chip that does nothing but mine Bitcoin. So the
Or any of the SHA-256 specific coins.
Yes, only the Bitcoin type and the Bitcoin clones can be mined by ASIC. There's a large split at this point where their Litecoin was developed. And what Litecoin was a way for these old GPU graphics cards miners to continue mining, even with the ASICs, because the ASICs were thousands of times faster than the graphics cards. So they wiped out the graphics cards. They all moved over to Litecoin. And then what happened was Litecoin, like Bitcoin, is an open source project. So if someone wanted to come along and make a copy of Litecoin, they do. And there's hundreds of copies and variations of Litecoin, some with exciting new technology, some with just a changed name and a few changed variables.
Or some with every bad quality added and intentionally called shitcoin.
Absolutely. Or coins with incredible amounts of coins, like Dogecoin, which has over 100 billion coins, where Bitcoin only has 21 million coins. Or you'll have a coin like 42coin, which only has 42 coins.
And, you know, so if you get like 0.401, it's, you know, you have like something that's worth like $15 or $50 or whatever, just from this little tiny fraction. And then that's, of course, based 42 is obviously times two on the Bitcoin, and then making it the total number of coins ever available.
Absolutely. And 42 coin for a fractional amount, you would have a greater value than a fractional amount of Bitcoin because there are so few coins.
Now, what I understand about Bitcoin and all, you know, the different script coins compared to the SHA coins is that each of these coins, for it to really be successful, let's say now they start off on CPU mining, just like Primecoin, Rycoin, Metis coin, some of these other coins, they, you know, they're CPU specific. And then we saw, for instance, in the beginning of January, we see ProtoShare coin becoming mineable by GPU. Now, to me, this seems a natural and needed progression, because for the coin to grow and become more and more secure, the network has to be faster and faster. And, you know, for instance, for Litecoin to be successful in the long run, it's going to have to eventually be able to get some sort of ASIC type chip to mine it. And then that way the network is faster, it becomes more secure because there's more people that can check it, etc. Then it's resistant to 51% attacks, you know, and on. Does that sound accurate to you?
The ASICs, I mean, they have made the Bitcoin network faster. They have, initially it was thought that it would spread out the power, but it has centralized the power. There's a lot of large ASIC mining rigs that open Bitcoin up to the kind of attacks that we saw on centralized institutions like eGold and Liberty Reserve. If you took out a large Bitcoin mining operation, disconnecting their power, disconnecting their internet connection, you could have an effect on the Bitcoin network. You could make Bitcoin easier to mine. There's a possibility a government or a large corporation would have that kind of interest, and having these centralized locations may not turn out to be necessarily good for the Bitcoin center. It might be better to have a bunch of small servers like the Litecoin servers. But
you do think that the Intel community is mining and definitely taking interest in this stuff?
It's tough to say. I mean, there are large scale mining operations going on. They're businesses or they're, you know, funded businesses. I don't know.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, sometimes when you see like, you know, I've seen these rigs on the script side doing like 118 mega hashes, and you know, that is, I mean, you're talking, you know, probably $250,000 at least to set something like that up, and then just trying to source all of the GPU cards for that would be just a feat that I can't even imagine.
Well, but there's obviously good money in it. These people would get paid very well. So there is a reason to do this, and they are being set up. What we're seeing right now is a lot of ASIC-resistant coins. Things like Particle Coin and Vert Coin have, and even Max Coin, have algorithms that are designed so that if ASICs were developed for script coins like Litecoin, which they are being developed. It's a bit of a technical problem where to solve the problems of script, you need more RAM. So of course, it's more expensive to make an ASIC and then put a bunch of RAM on the board. But eventually, they're going to figure that out. And there will be ASIC script coins. But then there's going to be this new group of ASIC-resistant coins.
Right. Now, you know, doesn't it have the potential, though? I mean, today, anybody can go out and buy a small ASIC miner for, you know, $49 or whatever and, you know, get a mega hash or two going right off the bat. So, I mean, is it a good idea to steer away from ASIC, do you think?
Well, it seems in the recent times that it's always been more valuable just to buy Bitcoin than to buy Bitcoin mining equipment. It is nice you can buy mining equipment on a credit card, so that might be an option for some people attempting to get Bitcoin, essentially. But the problem with Bitcoin mining is Bitcoin difficulty. When you have all these computers out there trying to guess the number, the Bitcoin network adjusts if there are more computers on the network. If the Bitcoin network was 50,000 and it went to 100,000, you'd have a period there where the network would be mining the Bitcoin very quickly. Then after that period was over, the Bitcoin network would adjust the difficulty up to the 100 level, and we'd go back to mining at the same rate. This adjustable difficulty level makes it so that if you only have, like, you know, 100 gigahashes and the difficulty keeps going up, what made you maybe a Bitcoin a month last month is going to make you, you know, 3/4 of a Bitcoin, and then 2/4 of a Bitcoin, and then 1/4. So your money does keep going down as the difficulty keeps going up. So it is very difficult to get into Bitcoin mining. It's not that difficult to run the machines, but making the profit, keeping your machines upgraded, the value of the hardware goes down. And obviously, as you can see, the value of their output goes down as well.
Now, what about a lot of people are into mining the altcoins and then, you know, like Coin Wars, for instance, some coins are actually more profitable than Bitcoin to mine. And so then they'll mine those coins and then trade them for Bitcoin or hold those coins, etc.
Absolutely. And a lot of exchanges will allow you to send the coin there. You could then auto sell the coin. If you were mining Dogecoin or Zetacoin, you didn't believe in the future of those coins as much as you believe in the future of Bitcoin, but you could mine them at a higher percentage rate, you could instantly trade that currency into your preferred currency of Bitcoin. The altcoin mining is certainly the Wild West. A lot of the altcoin action, I believe, is about people who missed their opportunity with Bitcoin and then now, sadly, kind of missed their opportunity with Litecoin and are looking for whatever the third coin is going to be. And they're trying to get rich quick. And certainly that could happen. Coins like Vertcoin went up 400%. Other coins have had similar rises and similar falls happening right after that. The altcoin market is very varied and it's constantly moving. So you could be, but the thing is, if you're mining altcoins, you might be able to get to the coin before it's popular. You might be able to mine a lot of the coins when they have no value, which again is a risk. You have to be saying that you prefer Ultracoin, you prefer Potcoin, you prefer PandaCoin. And one of those is going to be a winner and one of those is going to be a horrible loser. PandaCoin had all of its value gone recently, made it to one or two exchanges, but it looks like it isn't going to make it beyond there because of disagreements with the developers and one of their promoters. And that could happen to any of these coins.
Right. And, you know, Potcoin has so far seemed to gain some foothold and is gaining in popularity. And I think having the hemp and medical marijuana community behind it is a big help because that's a fairly large activist community.
It would be great for the dispensaries and even the recreational businesses to be able to accept Potcoin or even just Bitcoin because they are put at such a risk by having so much cash around, basically setting them up for crimes, setting them up to be robbed, which is, of course, why the president recently allowed the banks presumably to work with these companies, although I'm not sure it's actually happening yet.
Well, you know, and speaking of that, we just had an armed robbery at the dispensary quarter mile up the street from us. They came in and beat the people in the head with shotgun butts and locked them in a closet and stole all of the weed and the money. And so, you know, exactly. I mean, if you could go in and bleep, bleep, I mean, what are they going to steal? They might get a couple of pounds of medicine, but, you know, we can grow that again and replace it. But, you know, if somebody gets shot or whatever, it's a terrible loss. So let's get into...
Well, and Bitcoin could do more for that. It can also provide a system where they could pay their employees. BitPay, although BitPay won't work with dispensaries, they might change their mind now. They do have an entire payroll system. So if you were taking in your money through Bitcoin, holding it in Bitcoin, paying your employees in Bitcoin, you wouldn't even need traditional banking services to run your dispensary. You could just start accepting Bitcoin.
Interesting. All right. So let's get into funding, civilian projects or Kickstarter type projects, things like that. I know there is a whole lot of new information coming out about that. We see this stuff coming out recently, getting $25,000 into the hands of the protesters in the Ukraine in seconds. And, so let's go into this type of thing. What can we see happening there?
Well, obviously, there are major advantages that Bitcoin has over the Kickstarter type system. We've seen in the past where WikiLeaks raised a lot of money through PayPal, but then PayPal froze all the funds because they didn't like what WikiLeaks was doing. Other organizations have had problems where they can only take funds from their country. They can't take funds from the entire world. What Bitcoin allows you to do is to now kickstart your funds with the entire world and to do it publicly. During the recent typhoon in the Philippines, an organization called FR33 Aid raised money for the Philippines. What they did is they had their public blockchain address, which I could look at. So this allowed me to monitor the fundraiser. So anyone on the internet could see if money was flowing into this fundraiser. Then when they started to spend the money, I could see the spends on the blockchain. So I could see that they were spending each money. They were able to annotate it, provide pictures on their blog. And I was actually to see the things that I bought be purchased at a Walmart type big box store, taken to a harbor, broken up into individual parts, put into bags. The bags were loaded on, they look like jet boats. And the
So what you're saying is, like, you know, where these huge organizations set up by the Huxleys, like the World Wildlife Fund, and the Huxleys were into all this eugenics and stuff. So basically, these organizations take all of these public donations, and then it disappears, and maybe 1 or 2 or 3% ever reaches to the people. But what you're saying here is that you, looking at the blockchain, could send money to the other side of the planet and then watch it every single step of the way.
Absolutely. And so many of these charities, you see your donation eaten up by administrative costs, commercials, multiple levels, fancy meetings at the football game, whatever it is, United Way, these kind of organizations. With Bitcoin charities, and we're seeing a lot of these, like Sean's Outpost, which gives sack lunches to the homeless in Florida, the money goes directly in and the money is spent directly. There's no, if there is administration costs, it's donated by people who believe in this cause, or they take a small portion for themselves. But we can see exactly where all the money goes, and you can just track it. It's an open currency system, so it's perfect for this type of organization.
And weren't they declared a terrorist organization recently for doing this, for handing out sack lunches?
In Florida, especially in the Pensacola area, apparently they have very strict laws against homelessness. It's pretty much a crime to be homeless there. So if you're giving a blanket to someone sleeping in the park, you're aiding them in committing the crime of being homeless.
So yes, if they've lost their everything in this banking nightmare system that was put on them and on all of us for that matter, and if they found themselves homeless like many millions did since 2008, then they were criminals.
I believe the plan, and it's an unfortunate thing to say, I wish it wasn't true, but I believe the plan is probably to push these homeless people out of a nice community. I don't know Pensacola personally, but presumably out of a nice community into another community. We've seen this in the past with Nevada was putting their homeless and their mentally ill on buses and shipping them to California. There's been a lot of stories about this, and they're just trying to hide a problem instead of solving a problem. There's no attempt to help these people to get them back on their feet, to provide shelters or to provide internet access, to give them any options.
And Pensacola is a very poor area, and they can't really help sustain these people, right?
I don't know, perhaps.
I'm being totally sarcastic.
Well, so that's their attitude.
But. All right, so you know, what other things do you think are really important and key for people to understand about Bitcoin and how, you know, it affects the money system? You know, I look at, if you take the value of, if you take the value of the Bitcoin, as somebody explained to me, it's not necessarily the value of Bitcoin going up, but the value of the dollar dropping. So now, do we hold our money in this inflationary dollar that we can guarantee is going to be worth less in a month? I mean, it may be even worth less half as much in a month from now as it is today versus one that either holds its value or is deflationary and goes up.
Well, and they're printing incredible amounts of these dollar bills electronically now. We don't even really know how much they're printing, and most of it exists on their books electronically. With Bitcoin, there are only 21 million coins.
So what you're saying is when you go into the bank and get an auto loan or a house loan, they're not just going to create 40,000 more Bitcoins right there on the spot and give it to you?
There's no way to just create a note and say that the note has value and that value is Bitcoin. In the future system, if you want to talk about houses, what it's probably going to be is that you'll use a special colored coin that will represent the deed, and that the one party will set up an escrow account, like I was talking about earlier, with programmable currency. You can use internet and computer programming concepts with money now. So you could say, if this account has $115,000 in it, which is an escrow process, usually takes about 30 days. It's a long process in purchasing a house, but this would just be a computer program. If the money is there, then send the deed to this person. So the person pays, the person gets the deed, you own the house. If you want to sell the house again, you use the same system. You put the deed up, you say how much you want. If they pay, you give them the deed. And that's property transfer in the future.
So where will all of these government jobs go?
I don't know. There's still going to be support systems. I mean, I do believe that crowdfunding can give us police, fire, and libraries, streets and parks, services that we do actually use. I believe it's going to be very difficult to crowdfund. Well, it's difficult to crowdfund a military. I think it's going to be difficult to crowdfund drones or bombs or nuclear weapons.
Right, yeah. You pretty much need a central bank that can just hit the printing button for that, don't you?
It seems that even going back to the Napoleonic Wars, there were outside companies that loaned money to the British government, allowing them to go into what looked like at the time infinite amounts of debt in order to win the war, in order to buy more weapons than the other side, more troops. This has happened time and time again.
So now, if it was being run on Bitcoin, then your average person could go in and look through the blockchain and actually see where the money was going, and then they could say, you know, we're not going to fund this company anymore.
Absolutely. And I think that there will be more radical transparency.
And let me just interrupt. I do recommend people go back and listen to my 5-part series with Larkin Rose, because he really lays a lot of the foundation on this material. So when you plug in what Bitcoin and these altcoins and Ethereum, et cetera, are offering, the Lakota have supposedly adopted officially now Mazacoin, which launched a week or two ago. And so, we have the first Indian nation that's officially adopted a coin, and possibly very soon, maybe Iceland with the Aura coin, et cetera. Some things, interesting stuff going on around that. But, so these are our whole new vistas. Sorry to interrupt you on that.
Well, another thing about Bitcoin is that I've mentioned before how Bitcoin doesn't have a founder or a creator. Satoshi Nakamoto is, we don't know, it's a generic name used for perhaps a team of mathematicians or a very smart individual mathematician. And what we know about this guy or woman is that they disappeared. And if you look back at Greek history, when Prometheus brought the fire to the people, he was rewarded by being strapped to a mountain. Then the eagle kept coming back every day and eating his liver out. His liver would regrow. Then the eagle would come back the next day to eat it out again. Obviously, Satoshi Nakamoto didn't want this to happen to him or her or them, so they stayed quiet and anonymous. So this is yet another sign that perhaps Bitcoin is not from the powers that be, that it is a true surprise.
Somebody, you know, some people would claim, well, the fact that the creators of it are, you know, anonymous, that this is more evidence that it was created by the Intel community and that they want to subvert it. But to me, you know, I see that all these banks and everything, just to even get into this, they're going to have to send their money out to gamers and miners and geeks to even begin to acquire the coins, or they're going to go out to IT companies and they're going to pay them to, you know, for all of the hardware and everything else. And then no matter how they look at it, their holdings are devaluing every day.
Absolutely. And the banks are in a terrible position here. If I agree that on its face, you could say that the shadowy founder, the lack of a public creator, does hurt Bitcoin and could agree with a large government conspiracy theory. But if you look what Bitcoin's actually done in real world, in practice, it has enriched a whole trove of early adopters. There are a bunch of computer geek overlords that now control perhaps millions of dollars of this new currency. And if it keeps going up by a factor of 10, perhaps billions of dollars, who knows? There is a change happening with this technology, and that's what we saw with the internet. Disruptive technology disrupts.
So, you know, basically what we saw happen then was the, and this kind of seems a little bit odd, but the gamer that was down in the basement of mom or grandma's house sitting there with the graphics cards to run these huge video games, et cetera, these were probably the first millionaires out the gate of this, weren't they?
Absolutely. And it's all about timing. Certainly, if I'd been 5 years younger or in the right environment, when I was running these kind of programs on my computer, we were trying to find prime numbers. We were trying to solve cancer. We were trying to break encryption. Those are the kinds of things that we were doing with distributed systems back then, you know, maybe 10 years ago, around the year 2000. Now they're doing it to get money. And we were playing video games and trying to get them on the network. Now the cards that they used to play video games turned out to be these mining cards. And these kids who one day were playing Half-Life and generating no money started mining 24/7 and generating a few dollars each day. Then when Bitcoin went up 5,000%, suddenly they're in the money.
Oh, boy. It's you know, it's such a vast area to get one's mind around, aside from the mining. Thomas, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to understand regarding Bitcoin or any of these alt currencies as a takeaway point?
Well, I think it really comes back to the MP3 and the CD. That Bitcoin versus cash is what we should really talk about. Cash is old, it's inflexible, and it can't be sent across the internet easily. The CD is old, it's inflexible, and it can't be sent across the internet easily. The MP3 at the time was new, and I don't know if a lot of people remember, but there was only one MP3 player for a long time. You could only use Winamp. There were no iPods, there were no iPhones. So if you look at that time period and you say, how is this MP3 ever going to take off? How is it going to beat the CD when I can put the CD in my car? I can put the CD in my house. The CD seems so good and so unbelievably strong. And look at where we are now. The CD has been wiped out. The DVD and the Blu-ray isn't even taking off the way they wanted to because streaming video on Netflix has taken off so much and Amazon.com.
But wait a second. The government shut down Napster. Didn't that stop MP3s?
Absolutely not. When the government shut down Napster, it led to the development of BitTorrent. And BitTorrent allows you to break the file up into parts, download part of the file from many different computers, perhaps hundreds of computers, located anywhere in the world. Then the computer reassembles the parts, and you get to listen to the song like you downloaded it normally. And BitTorrent has been much, much worse for them than Napster ever was. Napster was a company they could have negotiated with, they could have worked with, they could have built licensing schemes into it. It could have become Spotify, which is a very popular service in the UK for listening to music, which includes advertising and has come to the US, however, 5 years, 8 years too late. They could have had a world where they could have worked with their customers. They could have even stolen some of Facebook's thunder and had you like artists on there. They could have had you buy tickets through Napster. They could have imagined a different world, but instead they decided to shut it down. They forced it underground. It became BitTorrent. It became much more powerful. And if they do the same thing with Bitcoin, it will happen again. Bitcoin is, Andreas was saying recently that Bitcoin is the most polite and reasonable implementation of a digital currency that we can do. Go ahead and make it illegal, and you'll see what we can really do. We can really program this thing. It can really become truly anonymous. It can become completely decentralized, and it can find its way through any firewall or server settings they want to put up. The more they tighten these things, the more it will expand. Even as we've seen with the Mt. Gox collapse and the wave of mainstream media shows that are suddenly, they never reported about Bitcoin when it became popular. They're only reporting about its death, which should be a sign to everyone. What's going on here? Why? They didn't tell me the beginning to this story, but they're telling me the end. They've skipped a whole lot. And I mean, pardon the interruption, a sports show that I watch, Archer, a cartoon show that I watch, The Daily Show, of course, have all, even Charlie Rose this week, a news topic show, have all mentioned Bitcoin and the Mt. Gox collapse and how it's negative for Bitcoin. It comes back to that Gandhi quote, you know, first they laugh at you, then they ignore you, then they fight you, then you win. We're definitely in the fighting phase now. They don't like this thing. They're trying to get rid of it. And as you saw with Napster, as you saw with BitTorrent, the internet changes things. It doesn't change things in a predictable and normal pattern. It changes things in an exciting new science fiction way. And that's what we've seen with Napster and the MP3.
Let me just, before we conclude here, some people would argue, you know, they're going to shut down the whole internet. What do you have to say for these types of things?
Well, obviously, if it all, you know, it's escalation. If they shut down the internet, we're going to have a lot of other problems. And we're going to know right away who the bad people are. They'll be the ones that shut down the internet. Whatever they do to force their hand. I know a lot of people are afraid about EMP guns. And if someone EMP'd your house, they would destroy your Bitcoins. Well, if someone's walking around EMPing your house, we have much bigger problems.
Well, they can EMP my paper wallets all day long. I'm not sure what that's going to do.
Yeah, paper wallets would be completely EMP-proof. Of course, they could, you know, burn down your house.
Sun flares, what about that? Is that going to destroy the whole Bitcoin network?
Again, the other neat thing about Bitcoin is that it is software. So if something did go wrong with Bitcoin, we could fix it. Things have gone wrong with Bitcoin, and they've forked the blockchain, they've cut off the damaged area, and they've rebuilt. They've continued with software, and that's what the altcoins allow us, is kind of a toolbox or a working area.
Yeah, that's what I said at the beginning. They're basically a laboratory or a testing ground for all this new technology. And then a lot of it gets adopted into Bitcoin or other things. And, all of these contracts and deeds and things that we were discussing earlier that are going to be made likely possible, hopefully soon, with Ethereum.
Absolutely. The contracts of Ethereum will be added to Bitcoin, as well as other coins like Zerocoin, which has anonymity features.
I was just
going
to mention that. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and one of the most interesting altcoins, I think, is Megacoin. Megacoin developed something called the Komodo Gravity Well, which is designed to fight multi-pools. A multi-pool is where the miners will work as a group going from coin to coin, trying to find a weak coin so that they could mine it, a lot of it, and then move on to the next coin. What the Komodo Gravity Well does is when it notices this mining spike, it adjusts the difficulty immediately in the next period so that these large mining pools can't own the coins anymore. They can't go from altcoin to altcoin running up a bunch of coins. And what's so interesting about the laboratory of the altcoins is that it started out as a Megacoin contribution, but through open source, more than 25 other coins have adopted this Komodo Gravity Well. So we can solve problems with software. A new problem comes along, we come out with new software to solve it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Thomas Hunt and a picture at what a society might look like without the government putting its boot on your neck all of the time and stealing a third of your money to continue this suppressive stuff, and not to mention the banks and everything else. Rather than fearing Bitcoin and listening to the mainstream media propaganda and regurgitating it, we need to do our grammar and our research and get down and understand it. And thank you, Thomas, so much for this first episode on Bitcoin. And I do plan to have a number of more episodes. I hope to hopefully someday soon maybe have a roundtable with you and Chris and Andreas on to discuss these key factors. And of course, Andreas is the chief security officer of BitChain Blockchain Info, and one of the Bitcoin devs or developers. So, you know, thank you so much for your time on Gnostic Media.
Thank you so much for having me. And I've got more shows available at madbitcoins.com. I do a weekly roundtable on Fridays at thebitcoingroup.com. And we're working on some new stuff at worldcryptonetwork.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you.